Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies. It's Monday, the 22nd of May, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Leinster's drive for five is halted by Ronan O'Gara and La Rochelle.
Field is taken here. Antoine Hastoy hammers it into touch. La Rochelle have completed a remarkable comeback, a remarkable display. It was some battle in the second half of this game. There were cards, yellow and red. And it is La Rochelle who have won this one. They haven't retained it. They have fought like hell to win it, and they've won it. They're the champions for 2023. La Rochelle by a single point, 27-26.
Good back, Corky. Plus, we'll be hearing from Ronan O'Gara and Stephen Ferris on all that shortly. While in boxing, we'll ask what's next for Katie Taylor after her defeat in Dublin.
Chantelle Cameron gets it by a majority decision. One of the great away wins by a British fighter. She said she was going to shock the world, and she's done just that. And you've got to feel that she's catapulted tonight to sporting stardom in Great Britain. Cameron beaming from ear to ear. She is still the champion, and Katie Taylor suffers defeat for the first time in her professional career. It was close, but Cameron wins it by two rounds on two scorecards. The third had it level.
And in hurling, we've Niall Moran and more Munster magic, while Wexford faced a drop in Leinster. Well, they could. And in the Premier League, we've Stephen Kelly on Man City's title win and that three-way relegation battle. My apologies to all Nottingham Forest fans who I had included in that too. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Well, it's John Kenny and Ruby Walsh in for a Monday. Good to be with you. And how was the weekend for you? Just to let you know that with our late, dear departed friend Larry Gogan gone to off this mortal coil, and Dave Fanning moving on, I am now officially the longest serving 2FM presenter. There's one
well
for
done.
You.
Well done, JK.
Yeah, joined here in 1989.
1989. I was 10. A lifetime, JK. A lifetime. Surely you get a good golden watch or something when you do this idea.
I do not golden watches. As Dave Fanning says, I don't want any awards. Just show me the money. That's what he says.
Or and show me the door.
Show me the door, the door. Tell us, how was the weekend?
Well, the weekend, JK, was all about sport, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I did hear your dulcet tones and a few commentaries over the weekend, but it was incredible. From the rugby to the boxing to the soccer, it was just wall to wall, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was doing a couple of voiceovers, a commentary on the Sligo match, and I did a commentary on the Galway game as well for the Saturday game. And yesterday they were saying, well, we'll just stick a few words on Westmeath against Wexford, and it turned out to be the game of the day. Westmeath, if you didn't hear, 17 points down at one stage, 16 at the half, and they came back to win it by two. What's happening in Wexford? We'll find out a little bit later on, won't we?
I think we want more learned minds than ours now to figure out what's going on in Wexford. I don't even think they know in Wexford what's going on in Wexford. But where are we going to start, JK? I suppose we have to start with the low.
Yeah, we'll have to start with the boxing. And Kevin Byrne, the boxing correspondent with the Irish Sun newspaper, joins us now. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm good, and yourself, John? Yeah. Hi, Ruby, as well.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Good, good. What did you make to the weekend? I know we'll have a listen to the interview first. I think, actually, we will have a little quick listen. This is Chantelle Cameron with Steve Bunce after the fight.
During the last four or five rounds when she was having better rounds and the crowd were roaring at everything she did, were you still convinced that you were going to get the decision?
If I'm honest, no, I didn't. I've seen it happen in boxing a few times. I thought I weren't going to get a decision, so I'm over the moon that boxing was fair to me tonight and the white woman got her hand raised.
And I'll be honest with you, that's what everyone said, even people inside Katie Taylor's camp. She was talking about, I hope there's a rematch. I know we should be celebrating. You're putting your feet up and ordering yourself a pizza and a bottle of Coke, but let's do that later. Could there be a rematch? Would you be a rematch? Would you like a rematch?
I'm going to speak to my team because everything was in Katie's favour this time. I was a champion. Come in first, come to Dublin, speak to my team. And like last fight, I fought Undisputed Fighter 147. This time, boxed Undisputed Fighter 135. I think it's time that I box someone for their belts now.
But don't underestimate, Chantel, how much respect the boxing trade gives you for what you did here. I'm with Michaela Mayer. I'm with Alicia Boomgardner. I'm with Skye Nicholson. I'm talking to Lauren Price, and they're all saying the same thing. All she wanted was the fight. She wasn't worried about who came first, what music came first, what anthem came first. She wasn't worried. All she wanted was the fight. Trust me, you're getting a lot of respect for that. I'm not saying do it all the time. I'm telling you, you got a lot of respect for that.
Look, it is what it is. I've always wanted the Katie fight, and I knew that I had to kind of just bite the bullet on everything and just say yeah and make the fight happen. And Katie made this fight. She went on Instagram. She wanted to challenge me. She stepped up and boxed me at 140. She could have dragged me down to 135. So, but all the respect in the world for Katie. What a fighter, what a champion. But it's my turn now.
Well, that's Chantel Cameron there after her defeat of Katie Taylor at the weekend. What did you make to the judge's decision, Kevin? One had it square and one and two had it two rounds, I think. I thought it was a little bit further than that. I thought it would have been a 3-0. But anyway, coming into Katie's back garden, I suppose she's happy enough to take the win.
Yeah, she showed what she's about, didn't she, Cameron? She was aggressive. She was physical from the start. She had a good game plan. She started well, despite being like she was made to kind of stand in the ring and watch Katie Taylor's quite long-winded walk in. And the whole question we were asking her beforehand: do you think it's going to be off-putting, you know, to watch Katie Taylor make her big long ring walk? But she started well, started very fast, built up a lead, and then when Taylor rallied in the second half, She'd done enough work as well and she took a few more rounds. I thought Cameron deserved to win the fight. Although I have to admit, sitting ringside and just taking in the atmosphere from the crowd, which was on the other side of us in the press seats, but you know, so it was like a wall of people kind of coming against us. I felt like I wouldn't have been shocked had Taylor's hand been raised as well, because in the 2-minute rounds that women take part in boxing, Taylor's always going to have her moments. So even when she's been attacked, you know, ripped to the body by Cameron, who's coming forward, piling on aggression to her, Taylor would always have her little flurries. She'd come back and she'd throw a few combinations to the head. So I thought it's possible she's going to nick some of these very close rounds as well. So I do feel the right winner was there. It was difficult to score quite effectively from ringside, but that's for sure.
I know Chantel said that everything was in Katie's favour, as in the venue and the walkout, etc. But surely the most important thing was the weight this fight was fought at. There's no way that was in Katie Taylor's favour. That was all in Chantel Cameron's favour.
Yeah, a lot of, Cameron made a few gestures towards Taylor. She allowed Taylor's name to be first on the poster, despite she was putting her belts on the line, and she allowed Taylor to, you know, walk in second, despite that's what the champion normally does. But that's kind of really ceremonial. That stuff doesn't really matter, doesn't it? And it shouldn't matter. Like you say, Ruby, Taylor was the one stepping up in weight class to a bigger fighter. And in fairness to Taylor, I think she's probably come up in the world as well a little bit. She fought effectively against the undisputed champion at a higher weight class and earned a draw on one card and lost by basically two rounds on the other. So she fought a good fight despite being not at her best and maybe looking like she'd maybe lost a step from her greatest victories over the last few years as well. But I think, yeah, Cameron, the fact that she was defending her belts at her chosen weight, well, she definitely had an advantage. One thing as well I have to admire Taylor for is, as the A side, when you're taking on someone at a higher weight, and we've seen the likes of Floyd Mayweather, Canelo Alvarez do this, you can pull a bit of a business move where you can meet them in the middle. So anything above 135, where Taylor is the champion, anything above it, so 136, 137, is technically a light welterweight fight. So Taylor probably could have negotiated to fight Chantel Cameron at 138 pounds or something like that, just so she was closer to her own natural weight. And I still would have had the light welterweight titles on the line, but Taylor didn't do that. She probably doesn't like that sort of behaviour. She wanted to go for it properly at 140 pounds. Weighed in and looked strong, but just, you could see that Cameron looked stronger in the ring there in Dublin on Saturday night.
Yeah, Cameron kept her undisputed world's welterweight, light welterweight title, and Taylor retains the same status at lightweight because, as you mentioned, those belts were not up for grabs this time around. So I suppose it goes back to my original question. You were happy enough with the way the scorecards were scored?
Yeah, I can't really complain about it. I think Cameron did enough to win. I'm fairly sure of it. Yeah, and I don't think Taylor was complaining. Okay, she said she's not going to sleep.
Rematch then, is that a good idea? I saw you, one of our colleagues writing in the Star today, and he's also a boxing correspondent, Kieran Cunningham, saying she should perhaps hang up the gloves now. No rematch. What do you think?
That's far be it for me really to tell a fighter what they should do. If she wants to fight again, she should probably fight again. But at the same time, her best day, she's had her best days in the ring. She's had her glorious days. Madison Square Garden last year against Amanda Serrano will never be matched. She's had her homecoming now at this stage, but maybe she just wants to pull it back. She's never lost before. And a lot of the most glorious days for a fighter is when they secure redemption against a fighter who's beaten them. You know, we see it all the time. Maybe that will be Taylor's greatest challenge. Get redemption against Chantel Cameron, possibly at Croke Park. I still believe Croke Park is going to happen. I think it's an ambition of Taylor's. But I think as well, she won't be satisfied now until she rematches Cameron. So far be it for me to tell a champion what she should do. You know what I mean?
You can see where Cunningham's coming from, can't you?
100%. I mean, there's been calls for Taylor's retirement now ever since the 2012 Olympic Games. Her father said she should retire. And every time she has a fight, and maybe she doesn't look at her best, Taylor's not going to come out and make excuses. She's never going to come out and say, oh, I had a leg injury or a hip injury, whatever it is. So we see her sometimes performing not quite at her best and think, oh, she's not the fighter she was, she should retire. But absolutely, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of people who think that Taylor should retire. I've seen many respected coaches come out with that viewpoint today. You know, boxing's a dangerous game, and every fight for Taylor at this stage, we've seen it now, she's picking out the hardest challenges she can take. Taylor could have easily fought anybody. I keep saying she could have fought the Lollipop Lady at home and sold out the 3 Arena, but she wants to fight against the best and most dangerous fighters in the world. With every fight, as the years advance, boxing becomes a more dangerous sport. There's really nothing else Katie Taylor can achieve. Undisputed world champion, Olympic champion, a game changer in women's boxing. And we've seen the difference she's made to her sport and the millions of fans she has around the world. There's really not much more she can achieve. But I'd say she feels she can achieve more. She wants redemption, probably wants to fight at Croke Park. And like I say, who am I to tell her what she should and shouldn't do?
No, but Kevin, and I don't know Katie Taylor. I had the pleasure of meeting her twice. But she's a champion. Do you honestly think, do either of you honestly think she's going to bow out on this?
I don't think so, but I would, if I was my daughter, I would be exactly like the father, saying, "Is maybe time? Think about your future health." You know, boxing, as Kevin has alluded to, is a dangerous game, but you cannot tell her what to do. Kevin, you've got a closer to it than I am, but that would be my way of thinking about it.
No, I agree with you, and I think you're right, Ruby. I don't think she's going to want to bow out on a defeat. Not many fighters get to bow out with a win. Some do, some don't. Yeah. And boxing loves nobody. And at the end of the day, many fighters come out of the sport after long careers in poor shape. And you know, Katie Taylor has secured her financial future.
Yeah, and she'll be more of it is financial, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and she's set for life, and she probably would have been set for life after walking away from the Olympic Games, because she's got good sponsors and she's got a great reputation. She's never ever once sullied her reputation, so she's sorted for life. And you know, there's never really a good time for a boxer to bow out, but I do suspect as well she's going to want to bow out to win. Now whether or not they can come up with a deal against Chantel Cameron, I believe that Katie Taylor, to her bones, wants to fight Cameron again. Absolutely, I've no doubt about it whatsoever. Even though she lost, I believe that she thinks she can win, maybe change a game plan, fight differently, maybe fight back at 135. That's where Cameron seems to want to take on Taylor. She'll leave her own belt at 140 untouched and then come back to Dublin to challenge Taylor for her belts. That's where Taylor's in danger of giving up her championship. But I think that's what Cameron wants. Maybe that's what Taylor wants. It's a mouth-watering fight at Croke Park. I think it'll gain the attention of the boxing world once more, and there's a chance we might see that. But look, if it's not Cameron, it could be Amanda Serrano, or it could be another opponent. But I don't think Katie Taylor's going to want to bow out with a defeat, no.
And 5 pounds is nothing till you haven't got it to lose, and then it's a hell of a lot of weight. I hope to take each other on again at 135. I think it'd be an incredible fight. But look, best of luck to Katie Taylor and to Chantel Cameron. And Kevin Byrne, thanks a million for taking our call. We have a quick break to take.
Welcome back to Game On. John Kenny and Ruby here with you until 7 o'clock tonight, and we're going to talk all things rugby now. It's been widely reported that La Rochelle and Leinster had a bit of a dust up at half time in the big game at the weekend, which La Rochelle won by a single point. A heck of a game of rugby. I wouldn't be the rugby's biggest fans, but that was a really, really, really good game. ERC have announced a statement today saying it's aware of reports of an incident at halftime during the Champions Cup final at the Aviva, and the tournament organiser will be investigating this as soon as practicable. We'll be talking very shortly to Stephen Ferris, the Ulster Ireland Lion icon. But this is the reaction, post-match reaction of Rog. He's been speaking to Damien O'Mara.
A remarkable achievement by a remarkable group of players.
Yeah, it's fantastic, Damien. We're absolutely buzzing. It's very, very special, and it's even more special considering how we did it. The boys stayed in the fight. It was easy to jump ship, but credit to the leaders, credit to the 23 who took the place today. But you got to remember, we have 40 guys that go hard every week. Some of them are gutted not to be involved. It's a horrible part of the job, leaving these guys down, leaving them out, giving them a message, crushing their self-belief, their plans to make an impact in the biggest game of the year. So it's been a hard week, but it finishes beautifully.
There's an awful lot of talk, and understandably the Irish media focuses on Leinster and what Leinster were trying to achieve this week. Did you get the credit for what talent existed within this squad in advance? Was that part of your thinking beforehand, that, you know, this was a far more 50-50 game than anyone maybe was given a credit for?
But we weren't given a chance, you know, and I think there was probably no evidence for that to take place, and the fact that I think Leinster have won Heineken Cup in 11 years. So the perception is very different to the reality. Some people obviously have very good skills at drumming up a spicy story, but we stripped all that back. We believed in what we were able to do. We understand it was going to be incredibly difficult and a big task, but the path was clear for those who were willing to take it.
Can I ask you about the group collective? Because I think your young lad was looking after Will Skelton's young lad at one stage. Dunica Ryan was like, you know, the Pied Piper. He had so many children around him at one stage. How big a role does that play? Because I know it's a cliche. You have built a family of which there's 40 rugby players in the middle of it and maybe 80 or 100 people outside who facilitate them to do what they do on the pitch.
Yeah, it's very important, Damien, because none of these guys are bachelors, you know, so you have to include the families, otherwise you don't succeed. And behind, I do firmly believe in behind a good man is a better woman, and nowadays obviously is behind a better, or a good man could be a better man as well. So in that regard, we put huge emphasis on it, and we have barbecues, and but it's very natural and it's very easy. But I'm very, very strict on who I sign. I will do a thorough investigation in who comes into the environment, and I think for the first time we've had everyone is very, very pleasant, and then you work on their competencies, but first of all you get good people in the building.
Final question, third consecutive Champions Cup final, fourth European final in a row. How important was it to win that second title and consolidate what is it? Like, and I know, like, people fixate on stars. A good team can win one. A great team will win multiples. You're now a great team. Noel, you were a great team at the start of the day.
No, you're right, but it is, because it just rules out any debate, really, and the fact that what I felt this team are capable of, they've come away from Lansdowne Road with the cup. That, for me, was the most important thing.
Damien O'Mara does a good interview. He does a good interview there with Ronan O'Gara, Ruby, using the phrase bachelor. I haven't heard that one for a while.
I love the way he keeps calling it Lansdowne Road. He's never going to call it the Aviva, is he?
Exactly. And Stephen Ferris, good evening to you, sir.
Good evening. How are we?
Good. Ruby, crack away there.
Stephen Ferris, I listened to your commentary at the weekend, and I must say, while I'm a friend of Ronan O'Gara's, I felt for all those Leinster players walking off the pitch, and I must say, to listen to Josh Van der Fleer afterwards, I thought, what an amazing person.
Yeah, I suppose in a game like that, Ruby, you experience such highs, like, because you've taken that 17-0 lead, you're absolutely flying, and then the house sort of comes tumbling down on top of you. And when they were knocking on the door in the last couple of minutes, unfortunate red card, you know, just the way it happened, it was a red card, simple as that, and that was the game. But you know, I did feel for the Leinster players, chatting to a few of their backroom staff before the match, and they were all cool, calm and collected, just the way La Rochelle were. They were obviously confident in their own ability and belief and what they'd built. A number of their lads had been rested over the last couple of weeks, so they were ready and firing to go. And unfortunately for Leinster, you know, La Rochelle came back into the game and, you know, their forward dominance got on top. James Ryan going off after 30 minutes was a huge, huge blow. I thought Jack Conan was playing superbly well. They changed him early enough in the game as well. And yeah, I suppose now when Leinster get beaten, Ruby, you know, the conversations that are being had after that defeat is, you know, geez, lads, this is the majority of the Ireland team here. Now we're sort of a little bit worried about heading towards a World Cup when the likes of South Africa have a really dominant scrum and maul. France can have exactly the same. You know, is it going to be a similar outcome if we face a, you know, a big, strong brute of a side in a knockout game? And, you know, that is a concern moving forward.
That's all it got down to, the power struggle or the arm wrestle in the end. It was just out-muscled, but they never backed down, did they? They never gave up.
No, they never give up, and that's something that, you know, I'm sure Leo and the other lads can be very proud of. And, you know, I seen a stat coming up in the monitor when I was working at the weekend, around about 60-odd minutes, and Leinster had made close to 160 tackles, and La Rochelle had made just over 35. So, you know, that tells its own story and who had most of the possession. And a lot of people are saying that Leinster, you know, tried to play the game out, you know, try to protect the lead. I'm not so sure that they did. It's just a couple of poor exits, and, you know, the pressure just kept coming, and, you know, really good ball retention and but by the La Rochelle team. And when they get into, milked a couple of penalties around the mall, and, you know, they nudged it into the corner, and with the guys that they have in their pack, they, you know, they can maul over any side in the world. So, yeah, really disheartening and unfortunate for Leinster, but ultimately they come out second best. And I know the referees may be coming under a bit of heat, as Frank Murphy did in their defeat against Munster, but I thought the referee done a half decent job. And yes, the breakdown was frantic and there was bodies flying all over the place, but that's what you want to see in a final. That's what you want to see. And yes, some of it might have been illegal, but, you know, I think it was very much the same for both sides.
Yeah, I mean, it was tit for tat, or it appeared to be. I'm not an expert by any manner of means, but when you looked at it, you say controlling the game, a couple of poor exits to get out of their own 22, but ultimately in the last 4 or 5 minutes, were there things they could have done or should have done differently, Leinster?
Of course, like, of course, you can. We can all say that now. If, you know, Ross Byrne nudges it into the corner and they pick and jam, just like Leinster do every single week in the URC, and usually come away with a 5-pointer, then, you know, that's all right. And the Michael Alatoa incident, you know, he's probably good flying into rucks like that every other breakdown. It's just the shoulder is just, or the arm is just slightly tucked. And when I think it's Cologne, the sub prop, you know, the way he was just coming up out of the breakdown, it was just an unfortunate moment, and it was the right decision. But was there an opportunity for Osborne to sit into the pocket like Jack Crowley the week before and nudge over a drop goal? We were seeing a couple of times maybe down the short side. Like, I think Gibson Park has to take a bit of responsibility as well. Everybody's saying, you know, it's Ross Byrne needs to control that, but Gibson Park was the guy who, you know, right in the middle of the pitch, like, he threw a 20 or 30 meter pass back down the short side for them to run out of room again, and then it's almost like you got to go another 6 or 7 phases to get back towards the post. So, you know, I think there was a few decisions made on the pitch at that time that, you know, if they could wind back the clock, that maybe would have just picked and jammed and hopefully set up a good opportunity for Ross to put it over. And he also hit the post with a couple of kicks. Like, you know, it was a 1-point game, and, you know, one of those goes over, you know, 6 inches is the difference there, and it goes over the bar. And, you know, Leinster are the European Heineken Cup champions. So, I'm sure there's a lot of learnings, but at the minute, I'm sure it's a really down and depressed camp in Leinster, because yet again they've come up short in both competitions, the URC and the Champions Cup.
There is an edge to these two, isn't there, now, with the talk of another tunnel bust up, and both in not just this one but last season's referee Wayne Barnes in the Velodrome in Marseille, where he's been involved with altercations outside the referee's door. The ERC are going to have a look at this, and or ECHU are going to have a look at this. What do you make to it? Do you know anything about it?
I wish I did. I wish I had could spill all the beans to you two lads, but unfortunately, I don't have too much more than what's already out in the press. I think Ronan O'Gara obviously approached the referee at halftime last year in their cup final. He wasn't happy with some of the decisions, and I think he had the same idea to do exactly that. And
but he was stopped this time, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, he was stopped.
Allegedly,
allegedly, yeah. I think there was a couple of Leinster players named Johnny Sexton and Sean O'Brien who seemed to be floating around the altercation, and Will Skelton's name's been brought into the mix as well. So I'm not sure if Ronan actually got to speak to the referee or it all was a bit of a commotion outside. But
well, he was obviously on he was on edge because a lot of his players, one or two of his players, said that Leinster was showing them a lack of respect.
See, this is just mind games for Ronan when they meet in the final again next year. Like, this is a really good coach, and I think La Rochelle had their number in terms of the mind games getting into the game, into this game. You know, there were Leinster were being talked up all the week. There were 8 points favourites for the bookies. You know, everybody could not see past Leinster winning, and Rog was, you know, making sure that his players were well aware of all this hype and, you know, people blowing smoke up their backsides, and you know, they're the ones that come out on top. But something like that just fuels this rivalry even more if they meet again next season. And some might say it's good coaching, some might say it's a little petty, but it's working for him, isn't it?
I think it's definitely working for him. I think the mind games are fascinating. And
In the old days, Ruby, it was the case of, you know, get the newspaper cut and stick it up on the dressing room doors and say, see if you can overcome these. So, I mean, yeah, look, it is mind games.
It's gone much deeper than that now, doesn't it? Now, by now, Fez, there is history there. Of course there is. Ronan, Munster, Leinster, Ronan and Johnny, one taking over from the other in Ireland. You could, like, it was obviously going to happen at some stage.
Of course it was. Like, and when you listen to Rog on the, you know, the RTE panel with Jackie Fiona and Jamie Heaslip, Jerry Flannery, like, Rog come over and he specifically, like, hammered home the point, I'm not home, I'm from Cork. Like, you know, I'm from Munster. Like, that's, do you know what I mean? He's thought about this before he actually, you know, comes out with it. He's very smart in everything that he does. And, you know, the red tracksuit top, wasn't it, in the press conference and 2 days before the game, again, representing Munster, that rivalry just building and building. We all know the history between him and Johnny Sexton. There's been good blood, bad blood, and then everything else in between. But it seems to be back to bad blood again because, obviously, they spent a lot of time together over in Racing 92, worked together. And, yeah, I don't know what you two guys think. I absolutely love it. I think it's brilliant. No, I think it's good.
Listen,
the game.
Mind games is brilliant in any sport. I mean, it just it intrigues the public as well. Puts bums on seats too. Don't forget that. And brings in sponsorship deals. If you've got an edge, bring it on.
Yeah, bring it on. And, like, any of them, the Leinster fans walking out that I was sort of chatting to off comms, and they're like, oh, we're so disappointed, but, you know, I have a bit of a soft spot for Rog.
Yeah, that's like, the thing. You know? Yeah, yeah. We don't mind listening to Rog, Jesus.
Yeah.
It was incredible for him, and he made a huge point of mentioning Donica Ryan as well and the work he's done in the line-out. He wasn't taking the credit all on his own. He was dragging in his Irish compatriot.
Yeah, like, obviously played with both those two lads. Donica Ryan's one of the nicest guys you'll meet, and he settled in really well. And, you know, that interview that you just played, that, you know, Ronan O'Gara mentions that he is very selective in the players that he brings in, and I'm sure that's exactly the same for the coaches and the guys that he wants to work with. He knows what they're capable of, their personalities, both on and off the pitch. And, you know, a skin, as he calls Donica Ryan, he's a damn good coach. And again, that showed at the weekend with the power of them all. And everybody just says it's about weight and size. Granted, of course, that certainly helps. But technically, they were very good as well. And, you know, he certainly won that battle against the Leinster boys. So, yeah, no, fair play to Ronan O'Gara and Donica Ryan and the rest of the coaching group. You know, that's another one on the notched up against their, you know, their long rivals in Leinster.
It most certainly is. Stephen Ferris, thanks a million for taking our call. It was an absorbing encounter, and I'm sure Ronan O'Gara and Donica Ryan are still enjoying the party in the harbour in La Rochelle. Time for another break.
Game on.
Hurley.
Welcome back, John Kenny and Ruby Walsh with you until the top of the hour. And we're talking hurling. Munster Magic, Wexford, are they facing the drop? Niall Moran, the ex-Limerick hurler, is joining us now. Good evening to you, Niall. Have we got Niall on Tyline 1? Oh, yeah. He's a phoner. Sorry, my apologies. Tell 1. You can tell I'm not new around here. Good evening to you. Niall Moran, can you hear me? There you go, there you go, there you go. Press all the buttons, one will eventually come up. How are you this evening?
Super, John. Horse, we're horse. Magical weekend. She's a magical weekend down here in Munster. And maybe with Leinster losing the rugby, probably might have eaten that as a cherry on top, but we can't really say that.
This is not a thing to be saying. All right, what about that game? Tip Limerick.
Yeah, Tip Limerick, where do you start? It's like going from La Bombonera down in Innes, where there was kind of a carnival atmosphere, and then up to the Coliseum in Thurles. It was just incredible. The last 15 minutes, I've seldom seen Thurles rocked the way it did in the last 15 minutes. Even there was one particular cameo where Cathal Barrett, who was heroic for 60 minutes he was on, he was coming off the pitch, and the Limerick crowd were giving it to him. They were jeering him because they felt he was possibly time-wasting, which he obviously wasn't. And then the Tip crowd were on their feet, roaring him to the rooftops. And at that point there, we just started laughing. Like I said, where else in the world would you rather be? There's people who take substances to try and get highs like that. And it says we were in the middle of it there. It was just incredible, incredible.
It was incredible, but it leaves Limerick in a slightly precarious situation. A lot of pressure on them next weekend against Cork now.
Yeah, do you know what, Ruby? There's times there, and I'm fortunate enough to come on here, and you're deemed to be trying to give it a little bit of analysis when you're probably a lot of the time not particularly qualified to do so. But I honestly, just coming away from yesterday, Ruby, I just said to somebody, like, how could you pass judgment on any of those guys, in both those Munster games in particular, who took the pitch? Like, I was walking out there, and I just saw these parents, and they're looking at their small kids, 5 and 6 year olds, who had the hurlies, and they're saying about going for a pup when they went home. And I just said, what I wouldn't have done to be in 6 or 7 or 8 years of age, going home, pucking, dreaming of being that age, dreaming of playing on a stage like that in 10 or 15 years' time. It was just. I won't say emotional, that's probably getting carried away a little bit, but it's just, it said you'd be so envious of the children, so in awe of the guys who played it, and you'd have so much respect for the people who put out those teams. And do you know what I mean? Those managers, those managements, like, we're all very quick to condemn and say they should be putting on X, Y, and Z. And these guys are in the heat of the battle, and like, even both sets of managers made huge calls in terms of substitutions, one that so-called experts may not have agreed with, and in both cases they came off. Like, even Graham Mulcahy's cameo for Limerick, it was hugely important. And there's a guy at the latter stage of his career, and do you know what I mean? He was just incredible. He got them over the line to get a draw. But look, going back to your original question, it sets it all up again for another Munster final on Sunday in Limerick. And you know, the Rebels are still hanging in there, and we're still hanging in there. So I think the only team that might be laughing at the moment are the Cats and Galway above in Leinster, because you know what I mean? It's been a bloodbath in Munster so far, and we're not finished yet.
As always, time is against us, so I just want to move this quickly on. Clare going about their business nice and quietly, Antley. They are into the Munster final as well, while a lot of focus has gone on Tip and Limerick.
I don't know if it was too quietly enough, to be honest. I think they made a lot of noise there yesterday during the match, and so they had a real hostile atmosphere. And look, they're building on what they did last year, and they're genuine, obviously, Munster contenders. They're only one step away from their Munster final, but genuine All-Ireland contenders. And up front, like Aidan McCarthy again, he was back in, he was another huge addition. But obviously, look, you can't look beyond the contributions of the ever-present Tony again, 1-4 from play, but Jeremy Ryan at half-back, he was imperious. He was a pupil of ours there going back in school, and it was there for all to see that he'd be that good. But just, he was just incredible. The nature of his score, some of his defending, and John Green to catch that ball at the end and be the final man in possession, it was kind of fitting of the contribution that he had made. So look, again, clarifying it, and Milson see what they play in the Munster final, probably most likely Tip at this stage.
I was working on the Sunday game yesterday, and they asked me to put a package together on Wexford against Westmeath, and this is nothing against Westmeath, I'll tell you, but I was talking to the editor, and I said a couple of pieces from the first, because they were so far ahead, a couple of pieces from the second, maybe a quick interview and let's get out of here. Lo and behold, as the game was progressing, it was getting worse and worse and worse for Wexford, and lo and behold, they lose. The biggest comeback in Westmeath's championship history, 17 points down, 16 at the half. What's happening in Wexford?
just all credit to Westmead. Like in
is it purely just credit to Westmead? They can't come back from 17.
I don't care what competition you're playing in when you're that far behind at half time. I'm sure it's just Ruby there, and when the horses, you'd be tempted to pull her up like or make her excuse.
I completely agree with you, Niall. Absolutely. When you're that far behind, to go back out with your hurl and give it a go, I think 99 out of 90.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that there is a problem with Wexford hurling. It's Westmead giving it a go is fair enough, but there's a problem now because Westmead or Wexford could be in the Joe McDonagh Cup next season.
Yeah, but look, as I said, it's a double-edged sword. Look, again, I just have to credit Westmead and that you cannot leave an occasion.
Well,
like
that's
this
an aside. We are crediting Westmead. That's not the problem. We're just wondering what's going wrong in Wexford.
Okay, so it's a lack of confidence, okay? And again, I'm not qualified to comment on Wexford per se.
Well, you did
but
say lack of confidence. So where is the lack of confidence coming from? I mean, they've got some of the best player hurlers in the country, in like the Leeds Chins of this world.
He does, but when you get to elite sport, it's a hypersensitive environment. And the one thing I often think that differentiates the really, really good players from the great players, etc., is the confidence. And that no matter what is happening, you still have that innate confidence to perform things. And when that leaves you, everything else, the things that have come so naturally to somebody, they become mechanical. And when things become mechanical and you're thinking about it and working on it, you then start to make mistakes. And it's like we've often said it, the harder you try, okay, it's like digging a hole, the further deeper
so
you're
so you do know what's going on in Wexford because you've experienced it yourself, haven't you? You've experienced it yourself, yeah.
Yeah, I have 100% and more so than anybody. And as I look back and reflect, sometimes, unfortunately, if it was an individual and a player, sometimes the only way to come out of a situation like that is to actually take two steps back, relax, just let it ride through. And if that means being dropped for a game or two just to get you out of the limelight, in Wexford's situation, what probably did happen was, you have to remember there were 17 points up at one stage. They had obviously done an awful lot very, very well to get to that point.
Yeah.
They tuned out. Next thing was the flow went against them. And it's like that. You're swimming against the tide and it just gets harder and harder and harder. And maybe look in hindsight, again, I only saw the clips the same as what you did. In hindsight, maybe they should have said, we should have killed the game. We should have started the rally.
Well, they got a penalty of Jack O'Connor, which would have killed it.
I know it was alluded to that maybe, look, that's where probably a leadership comes in, both on and off the pitch. And again, I'm sure it was a collective breakdown. And unfortunately, the price that's been paid is naturally going to be detrimental because, I don't know, again, we saw Offaly 2 weeks ago putting out a very weak team, or last week rather, putting out a very weak team against Carlow because they knew it was probably to their betterment. And is it quite possible that for Westmead's situation, they'd just be better off losing that game to Antrim because for the long term, John, it's highly unlikely at this stage that Wexford are going to beat Kilkenny, and I suppose for Wexford it's put them in a place that they never wanted to be. And look, I said I feel sorry for them, but they only have themselves to blame, and I suppose their form right the way throughout the year has been like that. And I'm sure after the first game in the championship when they played Wexford against Galway, when they started really well and got two goals, ever since it's just been a downward spiral. And I'm sure as players they just wish their year was over from a couple of weeks ago, and it's so hard to get going. But unfortunately, they have no other choice, and they're going to have to face that in their working lives, their personal lives. And I just hope whatever is going on down there, I hope that they don't take it out personally on players, because people do get carried away. And I'm sure each and every one of those players, and Darry Egan, knowing Darry, he's a good guy, they didn't go out for that to happen. But look, in my head, I'm just so glad to see another county come to the fore. Fair play to Westmead, take a bow. And to me, the story tonight is all about Westmead.
All right, Niall Moran, the man in the know. Thanks very much, Niall Moran, for joining us. Tomorrow, we've got Gaelic Football Review with Peter Callum, and obviously, we've got so much to squeeze in tonight. And after the break, we're talking to Stephen Kelly about football. Welcome back. Game on. Last 15 minutes or so, John Kenny and Ruby Walsh and Stephen Kelly. How are you, Stephen? How are you doing, mate?
John, how are you, Paul? You well?
Good, good, good. Man City win the league.
Yeah.
Three in a row, 5 out of 6. Financial impropriety. You cannot say that the players aren't good. They're excellent. De Bruyne, Gundogan, Haaland, huge amount of goals this year. But does anybody really care, bar Man City supporters?
Yeah, I think as much as it is a bit boring that they're winning it, I think the level that they're playing at and
it's the manner of how they're winning it in this financial fair play days. That's the problem.
Yeah, No, listen, I get all that. And I think it's a shambolic system. I don't think it's going to be fixed. I think C, you have 115 cases against them. And I think the fact that they've still been able to win the league and they're just going to fobber off with lawyers for God knows how long and not see it come to fruition or anything happen for it. But that to one side, the way Pep gets his team playing and consistently performing, and I think he's changing football. I honestly do. I think that I haven't really seen a team play like this before. Through all the years I've been playing, I think Arsene Wenger changed football for me when I was younger. But yeah, playing against those Arsenal teams, the way they played, he just relentless energy, power, pace, strength. He brought in a different dynamism to football,
and I think that changed the course of it.
Yeah. And I think Pep is changing here now as well. I think Pep's changed it. I just think that the way he has the players moving between positions, every player can play every position, which that's not football. People were pigeonholed to where you could play and where you couldn't play. Now he wants such a fluidity within his team that they can operate multiple different positions at the same time. I actually think it's pretty mesmerising.
All right, let's hear what Pep has to say about Manchester City's success.
It's not just the fact today the club told me, no, it's fifth Premier League in 6 years, but we have 6 and 10, 7 and 12. So that means a little bit more than a decade. So when you are a star now, you know, and said, okay, we start the Premier League right now, in the next 12 years, or in the next 6 years, we're going to win five. I cannot imagine. So this is what we have done. So imagine right now, we start next season, the fourth next season, we're one team, we're going to win five Premier Leagues. I cannot imagine, not even ourselves. So that's why we don't need, I think, 1 decade or 2 decades or 3 decades to think about how good it was. I think we had the feeling we had done something exceptional in terms of Premier League. Of course, to be considered one of the greatest teams, we have to win Europe, we have to win the Champions League. Otherwise, yeah, maybe people say, yeah, it was not complete our time here. But in the same time, if just in case we're not able to do it in number 10th against Inter or next season, we cannot do it. Always is unfair to say that what we have done with five Premier Leagues in the last 6 years or 7 and 12, that is something extraordinary. Everybody knows it. I think in the world football, all the managers in the Premier League, all the players, sport directors, clubs, boards and whatever, they know how exceptional it is.
Stephen, the treble is still on. Are they going to win it?
You just can't see them losing a game. I really can't. I just think they've got too many strings to their bow. They can keep the ball for 99% of the game, not let you touch it. And then they can also have the ability now to let you come on to them and catch you on the counter-attack and put balls in behind you and leave De Bruyne and Haaland up front, that them two alone could cause your, like they did against Arsenal, just they could absolutely terrorise your side. So I think they've got so many assets that it's very hard to see them not winning. I covered Inter Milan game for RTE, and against AC were really poor. Inter were decent, got good squad of players, work hard, got goals in them, defensively decent as well. But I just can't see how they would live up to City. And then on United, I know as much as Ruby would love to for him to go and win it, I'm sure even you'd be thinking this is a step too far when this team is in full flow. You can't go past.
I'd probably take penalties right now if you were.
I honestly, most Man U fans would. I think. You know what, Man U on the day, Man U will probably defensively have to be solid and trying to counter attack, catch them, get Fernandes, and try to play City in that way, overload areas, limit the space for them to play between, and then try and get Rashford on the break. Maybe get Sancho on the break if he's going to play. Anthony. And you know, it's a style that United have done well in the past, and you know they beat City. So, but at the moment, with the way they're playing, the confidence in that group of players, you feel like the inevitable will happen.
Sorry, you dropped out there for a second, Stephen. You were at Leeds West Ham. Leeds is still in the bottom three, despite taking the lead. Say hi to my brother Colin, who's a big Notts Forest fan. He had a very good weekend because his daughter Aoife has her communion as well, so he was a happy man. Forest are safe, so it's between Everton, Leeds and Leicester for the last two, and Leicester go to Newcastle tonight, who only need a point to get into the Champions League, so still a lot to play for at St James's.
Yeah, loads to play for St James's, but it's just, you can't, the way Leicester have been playing and the teams, that attitude to the players and the way they're going into matches, you couldn't imagine them going to Newcastle's last home game, which I think it is, and they are 1 point away from Champions League. I just can't see Newcastle not taking this opportunity to absolutely demolish them, to be honest, and go out with their fans in full voice, you know, on a Champions League adventure next season. It's been absolutely astronomical season for Newcastle. Exceeded every expectation that anybody could have put on them from where they were. And I just can't imagine them not.
It's great
not,
what money can do. It's great what money can do.
Yeah, it is. To be honest, you know what it is? It's the money side of it, isn't it? And I'm sure you're probably agreeing with this. But it's not the players they've bought. It's the mindset of the fans that has changed. I think we used to go to Newcastle before, and you'd get 1-0 up against them, and their fans would be literally all over their players. They would, like, they couldn't bounce back from it because the fans would have turned them so quickly. Now I think the fans are so elated because they just know that financially it's going to be, everything's going to be taken care of. They can buy whoever they want. They can invest in whoever they want.
And they don't care where it's coming from either.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's that's changed. That dynamic has changed, and it's made a huge difference regardless of the players in the pitch.
So Leicester won't come out of it?
No chance.
Who's going down? So it's Leicester going, Southampton already gone. So you got Leeds and Everton. One match
it goes last day of the season. Yeah. Like you fancy Leeds to get something from against Tottenham, because Tottenham have been absolute drivel at the moment, and it pains me to say it. You know, it's the same every week. Harry Kane scores a great goal, but Tottenham lose. Basically, that's what it is.
Yeah, Everton got Bournemouth at home, haven't they? Yeah,
but Everton at Bournemouth at home, and they've not been great, but you feel Sean Dyche will have enough to get that result they need in the last day of the season, you would think, and the fans in full voice. But yeah, they've been teetering on the edge for a long time, and you know, either one of those teams, there's only one's going to stay up. They all kind of deserve to go because they've been really poor.
Yeah, but if Leeds win, Everton need to win because they'll go down in goal difference. Yes. Otherwise, they're three behind.
Yes, so they will.
Everton have to win too. But Forrest, you can't
match that result.
I thought they were going all season, and then they get out against Arsenal. Oh. Fair play to them.
Oh, Ruby, I think none of us would have thought. Not anybody could honestly have said they thought Forrest was going to stay up. Not a chance.
I did.
The amount of change. Really?
Yeah, I honestly did. From about five or six games out, coming into the last run of the season, I thought there's a team playing for their club and for their manager. And they worked as a collective, and I thought, yeah, I think Forrest will stay up.
I think towards the last stages, possibly, but like early on in the season, I watched them on a few occasions and I just thought these look like a group of players that have no cohesion, nothing about them. And then, you know, you throw into that the amount of... Yeah, they were finding their feet, but it was just whether or not they would find their feet and whether or not the players they brought on there were willing to actually find their feet. When you see the signings like a Jesse Lingard and players that seem to just sign their mercenary type players that you felt, you know what?
I thought Lingard was excellent this year. He really played for Forest. I know he had his injury problems, but I thought he didn't fit into the United setup. He went to West Ham, played well there, got to Forest, plays well there, doesn't fit into the United setup. Horses for courses.
I don't think he's done enough for Forest this season. I think they were lucky, and I think Forest were lucky in the sense that teams around them were that bad. I think that's how they stayed up. I think Leicester should have been better, but they fell off. Leeds probably should have been down there, and Everton probably shouldn't have been in a higher position. But I think Forest are very lucky in the position they are because the teams around them, just no one was able to get a win. And Leicester, the whole too good to go down, that almost creeped into them, but then the points caught up on them. But I think for Forest... yeah, it's an amazing to beat Arsenal the way they did and the way they got about. I think the team did find the feet. Gibbs White, Brennan Johnson, I think two standout performers. But yeah, I would have absolutely nailed them on to go down. So I'm delighted for him to stay up. But yeah,
delighted for my brother too.
Yeah.
Well, I thought watching Gibbs White on Saturday was incredible. The effort he was making. So yeah, fair play to him. Some of the Leicester lads can do it, making an effort like it tonight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What about Liverpool then? Champions League football, all bar gone. United and Newcastle only need 1 point, draw against Villa. Firmino with a swan song goal at the end, but just hasn't been their year, has it?
No, they've been so off the pace. You know, will they bounce back from it? And tactical changes this season, Trent moving to the middle of the park. Like he's listening to Klopp, and Klopp is watching Pep and, you know, trying to get the best out of a player that they've struggled with. But defensively, it's been their issue all season. At times, they can look like that Liverpool of old. It's just the consistency level that they haven't got. But it's a rebuild, middle of the park, energy, legs, and they go again. And it'd be interesting to see what they do in the transfer window.
How do you think Arsenal's going to go next year? We've only got a minute left here. Arsenal, do you think they can bounce back from their fall late in the season?
I don't know. I think it's a massive blow. Two seasons in a row, they, like, missed out on Champions League last year, fell away last season, last year games, Tottenham caught them this season, you know, 238 games, top of the table, and somehow they've lost it. You know, it's a big, big drop, and they're going to feel so deflated, but it's about getting bodies in the door to try and revamp them and energise them.
All right, Stephen Kelly, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again, and Nan Ruby as well. Enjoy your evening. What have we got tomorrow? We have Peter Canavan talking football, don't we?
Alan Cawley's in the studio. Golf. Alan Cawley will be with us. Plenty still to talk about, JK. We only had an hour this evening, but we had way more than an hour's worth of sport.
Absolutely. Mark Langdon on European football. And I'll be chatting to the Irish cricketer, Harry Tector, who's now seventh in the world batting. That's incredible stuff ahead of the Lord's Test against England. Thanks to Ruby. I'm John Kenny. And we'll talk again tomorrow night. Coming up, it is Beta Da Silva.